I'm Gary Nolan. Nice to have you with us today. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the cycles of financial booms, panics, busts, and meltdowns, and why we're not learning our lessons. My guest from London, UK, will be Dr. Bob Swarup, S-W-A-R-U-P. He is a respected international expert and author in financial markets, and after receiving two master's degrees from Cambridge University and the University of London and a doctorate from Imperial College London, he went to work in the financial industry to manage investments. He sat on the boards of hedge funds and private equity firms, and he's worked closely with economic think tanks and policymakers. His articles have appeared on the Huffington Post, and his most recent is Money Mania, a booms, panics, busts from ancient Rome to the Great Meltdown. Nice to have you with us today.
Pleasure to be on the show, Gary.
I feel we should begin by having you define what the accepted and given forms of capitalism are today among our business and government leaders, and how this is a perverted form of expression of what is considered a true free market capitalism, and the symbolic and predatory relationship that exists between private interests and government that gives rise to this, I'll use my own concept, a perverted capitalism and cronyism. And what are witnessing today has been a decimation of the middle class, particularly in the U.S. and in some European countries, and the gap of empty space between the wealthiest small percent and the poorest majority is widening, with distribution swelling to the top. So I'd like you to speak about this trend that has continued since the 2008 meltdown, but it was forming long before then. And take your time. I want as many historical precedents that you can use to serve as indicators that our current economic system is destined for much larger bubbles than the 2008, and hence possibly a much larger crash. The form is yours.
Gary, thank you. I mean, I think you're right. What we have today is a very dysfunctional version of capitalism. I mean, if you look at capitalism and what it actually is about, capitalism is fundamentally about free choice. You know, you ultimately are looking at people who are producing goods, who are selling goods, and you're looking at people making individual decisions that are unconstrained by other sort of factors such as regulation, governments, and so on. Now, what you have today, of course, is a situation where I think we're probably very far away from free markets. I mean, in practice today, you know, you have lots of pervasive influences on markets that will limit the truly free exchange of trade. I mean, after all, you have governments, as you mentioned, you have cartels, you have regulators, you have central banks, you have all these institutions. And these institutions, I think what's important about all of them is that they are enormous repositories of influence on society as a whole. They actually create incentives that we as a society respond to. These incentives may be tax incentives, for example, they may be incentives of regulation, they may be incentives in the form of, sort of social norms. And what happens is that what we're doing now gradually is moving to perhaps one might say a more command economy in some ways. I mean, the example I always think of in the back of my mind is if I look at the Roman Empire and how it developed. You know, you had a situation where as the economy grew more and more, I mean, ultimately, you know, we have this innate sort of human bias, but the people at the top never quite want to let go. And so, you know, certainly if you look at regulation areas like that, one could argue that very often it's the largest companies, it's the most prominent ones that will always fight most for regulation because it effectively reduces the chance of them getting moved on. It increases the barriers to competition for new competition to come in. And in the Roman Empire, what that actually did effectively was over time, it increased inequality across the system enormously. It got to the point where, you know, it wasn't uncommon, for example, in the Forum to see Roman middle-class citizens who would actually be trying to sell themselves into slavery because it gave them food. You know, and the problem is when you starve a system from within like that, you hollow it out. And at the end of the day, what you end up then doing is collapsing it. And the Roman Empire eventually descended into feudalism. And the reason being, because the only way people found they could survive was to sell themselves into indentured labor onto large estates, where they could effectively be guaranteed some element of income and security in return for giving up other key aspects such as their freedom.
Haven't thought of that. I appreciate those insights. Thank you. Are there more particular historical incidences in the past that you feel are urgent examples of economic meltdowns that we need to be paying more attention to now? The total global wealth of as of 2013 was $241 trillion, but the debt is over $100 trillion worldwide and is expected to increase. But what does this actually tell us about wealth and who owns it and who owes it in our world today?
Well, wealth is one of those very nebulous concepts today. You know, I mean, when you and I look at our checking accounts, I mean, you know, I think the numbers we see are digital entries on someone's accounting sheet. In reality, what our savings are a series of uncertain claims on somebody else's debts, you know, their debt claims. We have no idea what they are. And, you know, one of the things that you pointed out with the sheer amount of debt we have, we live in a society now that is absolutely riven with debt throughout. I mean, debt is very much a structural part of our landscape. And, you know, debt is a tool. It's a very important tool when you look at the history of mankind. When you look at GDP growth, for example, over the last couple of millennia, I mean, the growth in GDP, you could argue, on one hand, is nothing more than a measure of the growth and complexity of our society, because GDP simply measures the number of transactions that we have with each other. And as these have multiplied and accelerated thanks to technology, thanks to, you know, global trade and areas like that, GDP has rocketed up. However, what's also fueled GDP are those growing links of money between us, the debt claims we all have with each other. And the real problem you have today is that we have made debt so structural to the economy that now we cannot live on any level without it. And I think one of the biggest tragedies of the last few years has been that we haven't learned the most important lesson from a crisis like the last one, which is that this was a debt crisis. This was what you may call a balance sheet recession. You know, we actually have a system where there is far too much debt in that system. You need to deleverage it, you need to bring it down, you need to restructure it. Unfortunately, we're not willing to take that bill. And so as a result, what governments have actually done is to add more debt onto it. And they've then made the problem worse by creating regulatory barriers, such as too big to fail, which actually mean that you made the problem a systemic problem. I mean, you know, the next time a big bank goes under, you have a real problem now. You've defined that bank as being too big to fail. So when it does go under, you actually have a major issue now with the economy.
I'm going to break this entire issue up into small pieces as if we have a broken mirror that's our economy. I'm going to put each of these pieces in perspective. Give us your understanding of them so we can make sense of it, all right?
Sure.
On the one hand, we're told by those in power or those speaking on behalf of those in power, both the policymakers that we rarely hear from, but the opinion leaders we do hear from, the people on Fox News or MSNBC or the people speaking from the Financial Times. These are the people who tell us what our supposed reality should be, how to interpret the events that we're seeing. Okay, they say that we should trust in a free market economy. They say that we should lessen the burden of debt, especially when it comes to major corporations and individuals, by reducing their tax rate. We should declutter the landscape of any of those pesky rules and laws. So they want to become unencumbered of regulations. Self-regulate, they want. We can take care of ourselves. Let the market regulate itself its best. Then they say that if you trust in a trickle-down economic theory, then the more money that these wealthy corporations and individuals have, the more they're motivated to make more money, and hence they're going to put people to work, they're going to build things, they're going to manufacture, they're going to distribute. Everyone benefits. Okay. And they don't really like the idea of a welfare state. They're always advocating, whether they're corporate liberals or corporate Democrats, doesn't matter. They're all advocating that we shouldn't be constantly subsidizing people. At the extreme levels of society, sure, you can give something to those who cannot do it for themselves. But otherwise, people are inherently lazy, they tell us, right? If you're not succeeding, it's not because somehow you're being limited, it's you're limiting yourself, and they'll use themselves as an example. I've heard Bill O'Reilly, I've heard Sean Hannity talk about how they become what they are today because of their own motivation. Then I get this reality check. I am never subsidized or helped by any agency of the government. If I cannot pay my mortgage, they'll take away my home. If I cannot pay for my business expenses, my business will close. It doesn't matter how good that business serves the community, it will simply be forgotten in a blink of an eye, and something else will take its place. There was a time when you walked up Broadway, you saw, in New York City, you would see on each block anywhere from 6 to 15 different small businesses. That all changed in the mid-1970s. Now, I'm still in one of those businesses. There's a store at 89th and Broadway. It's been there for over 30 years. It's a health food store. And one of the reasons that store is there is my determination not to see another mall, to see another bank, to see another drugstore, or to see another Gap or one of these large stores. Because the small stores are all gone. The system did not work for them. The benefits did not accrue to them. They were overtaxed, overregulated, and they had no advantages. So, there they go. All across New York, over 180,000 businesses closed. And they're not coming back. And this is true all across America. And yet, they, meaning large corporations, receive hundreds of billions of dollars a year collectively in subsidies, in effect, corporate welfare. All of them, Big Agra and Big Energy, the nuclear cartels, the oil and cartels, the gas hydrofracking cartels, the airline cartels, the communications cartels, the banking cartels, they're all made whole when they fail. So no one is held responsible when they fail. You and I commit a crime, we'll do time. They commit a crime, they pay a fine, and no one gets hurt. None of the major people who caused the financial meltdown have been held personally accountable. Not one of them. So, I'm confused now. If they're against welfare, and if they're against subsidizing, why is it only in one direction? Why don't they hold themselves to the same standards? If they truly believe in trickle-down, then why have we continued to bleed jobs and have more than 24% real unemployment, and they magically, as a society completely in delusion and denial, says if you're no longer looking for work because you cannot find work, then you no longer are unemployed, and you're erasing the statistics so they can all brag about a 7% unemployment rate when it's closer to 24%. And if you're a senior citizen and you're poor, you're invisible. If you're working middle class, you're invisible. If you're poor, you've never been visible. And hence, the only thing we focus upon are those people who are succeeding and never the people failing, and why. So if they're willing to play by the real rules of their capitalist philosophy, then if they fail, shouldn't they go out of business? Shouldn't they be held accountable? Shouldn't their shareholders or bondholders or stockholders pay the price by losing their money? Because if my house won't be bailed out and I have to go out on the street, as 44 million Americans have lost their place to live and have had to couch surf, living with in-laws in their basements and attics and garages or in their cars, then why should we allow that when these people fail, miserably fail, dumb as bricks, stupidest people I've ever met in my life are bankers. They're clever, they're psychopathic, but they're not intelligent and nor compassionate, yet we cannot bend far enough over to bail them out. So why aren't they playing by some rule that shows that they're something less than hypocritical? Those are my thoughts, please. Would you address them?
Well, I think, what it demonstrates is the fact that these aren't really free markets. You know, you have a situation where there is enormous inequality of opportunity right there, as you've laid out. I mean, in the last crisis, we had a situation where as bank after bank got into trouble, central bankers and policymakers around the world took the attitude that the bank debt was sacrosanct, that there was no way the pain could be pushed onto the bondholders, which is ironic when you consider the fact that the entire reason why anyone buys a financial bond is because they're getting a coupon that is supposed to be a premium to take on the risk of that bank. So why on earth, when a bank went under, was the decision never taken to actually take that money away from bondholders and use it to plug the hole that just appeared. I think more broadly what people never really think about is the link between capitalism and democracy. And let me explain what I mean. Free markets at its most basic level is about the exploitation of resources to produce goods and sell them on. You know, and the idea behind free trade and so on always has been decided by somehow having this exchange of goods and transactions, we enrich ourselves, society as a whole. And people always take that message, and you will always find people like some of the people you've mentioned who will take that message and say, therefore, deregulate, take away all the barriers, and let's go for it. However, at the same time, we have a system called democracy. And it's interesting that capitalism, by the way, has done phenomenally well under democracy as opposed to under other systems. And the reason for that really is because democracy requires you to share political power amongst the masses. And the focus of democracy has always been on the whole society being better off rather than some limited tranche. Now, what that means is that what democracy really does is that it creates large pools of consumers who have considerable discretionary spending power that can actually buy the fruits of this free market. They can trade, they can buy and sell goods. And so capitalism, in effect, benefits enormously from this by creating the complex web that can now link all these people together. And so if you're a capitalist in a democracy, you will always make a lot more money than if you're under any other system. Now, of course, what this also naturally leads to, in my mind, is ultimately a welfare state of some form, because the point is, if you have created the mechanism by which you can create all these consumers in order to give the market what it needs as customers, equally, there will always be ongoing political efforts to redistribute and share the fruits of the economic progress that you have participated in creating. And to me, that's a very powerful symbiotic relationship that actually nurtures entrepreneurship and innovation. However, as I said, very few people actually think about this link. They tend to pick one side or the other, and they very rarely think about how the two really intermarry. So, you know, when people talk often about bailing out, as you said, it always accrues to large corporations. And why? Because ultimately large corporations are always going to be closer to the seat of power. They're going to have a louder voice, and therefore they will always be able to get the airtime they need of the people that matter. Smaller people, small businesses and so on, very rarely get that opportunity. And this inequality that then appears, and the cartel-like behavior that accentuates it, it ultimately leads to a growing social tension. You mentioned the unemployment rate. That unemployment rate is by far the most critical thing. I mean, to me, the big number in the U.S. economy today is not the unemployment rate that is reported. It is not anything else but the job participation rate. The fact of the matter is you have fewer and fewer people working, and that means that they're actually giving up. Now, when they start giving up, you start making that pool of consumers, you make that pool of people who can pass in the economy shallower and shallower. And at some point, unfortunately, all the kind of fish that are swimming around in it, big businesses or not, will suddenly find themselves gasping for air.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you. There's something that we're not talking about in our society, and that is the insidious nature of making profits without providing something substantive to a society that it in turn can benefit from. And I saw this starting in the mid-1970s when a group of people, T. Boone Pickens, Carl Icahn, Ivan Botsky, Michael Milken, and Saul Steinberg, began to make money off money. Junk bonds was a part of that. Two of those individuals ended up going to jail because they were caught insider trading, Michael Milken and Ivan Botsky. But what bothered me up to that point was that you weren't able to make vast amounts of money. And those who were billionaires were generally individuals who, like J. Paul Getty, or the different families, the Rockefeller family, Mellon family, etc. And then suddenly it all changed. And over the next 30 years, nearly 28 million Americans lost their jobs, not because of anything they were doing wrong, but because someone came in and saw an advantage in buying their company and then either selling it in pieces or making the money on the deal itself, something that you're familiar with because you're familiar and work for equity partnerships. And I first saw this up front when I was young and out of college, and a close friend of mine had worked in a brick factory. Now, that brick factory had been there for over 100 years, and one day my friend said, Dad's lost his job, at the brick factory. And I said, well, he's been there for 35 years, hasn't he? He said, yeah. And I said, what's he going to do? Well, he was going to, you know, get his pension early, but then he found out that he and all the other employees no longer have a pension. And I said, well, that's not possible. They've been paying into it. It's their money. Yeah, but somehow the company that bought them was able to use their pension funds, and now they don't have any. So my dad is at 50-some years old. He's unemployed and has no pension, and it's going to be really rough. I didn't understand how it was possible. But recently I was filming a documentary on poverty that I've been filming since the crash. And give you one example. A woman who is 61, who worked for over 33 years for a corporation, was making good money by most people's standards. She's making $85,000 a year, plus benefits, probably brought her to around $100,000 or so. And then the company was purchased, and then she was downsized, and she is too young for Social Security, and she was paying for two of her daughters to go to Ivy League schools, which are very expensive. The national average is $30,000. Ivy Leagues can go as high as about $60,000 a year, depending upon what you're taking, what you're majoring in, and what other expenses you have. So now she had to pay for all this, plus she had mortgaged her home in the process of doing it. Until her kids went to school, there was no mortgage on the home. And she told me she had a savings of over $500,000. Now this woman is underwater in her mortgage. Her kids are no longer able to be subsidized in college. She's burned through all of her savings. She's living in one room in her house, and she's eating cat food that she is buying because it's cheaper than human quality tuna. She has sold off furniture. She sold off everything she has. She has a television and a telephone. And no one wants to hire her, even though she's highly qualified, because of the bias in the marketplace. Why should we pay you $85,000? You're 60-some years old, and we can get a kid who's, you know, 25 years old. We can pay him $30,000. And that's rampant out there. And then I said, well, what was it like? And she said, the worst part of it was we were actually training the people from India who were taking our place. And they were here on special visas. And they were willing to work. And the woman said, the person who was taking my place was working for $40,000. And I had to train them 3 months. And then that was the last that I was in the company. Now, this is a phenomenon that's happening big time right now. We're talking about over 8 million highly qualified. And I'm not blaming them, by the way, because they're wanting a better life. They've educated themselves. They're disciplined. They're hardworking. So the fault is not theirs if they can get a special visa, come to the United States, and get a job. The problem is that we're taking the jobs of those Americans who thought that they would have seniority, who were well along into the company and its hierarchy and its infrastructure, and now are gone. And so I'm looking at this, and I'm seeing that for a long time, we've had companies taking advantage of the idea that most people didn't understand what it was to come into a company, load it up with debt, take that debt as profit, and then have a company that has historically been well run, but now saddled with such a service on its financial debt that they go through a rough place, they can crash. Circuit City, Linens and Things, and over 5,000 other companies didn't go broke because they were poorly managed or didn't have product people wanted or quality product. It's because they couldn't pay the service debt to those hedge funds or equity partnerships or others that got the deal. And an average at that time was 7.2 years that it lasted once you were purchased. And now it's down to 4 years, unless it's a trophy purchase. And so none of the politicians, none of the presidents, none of the Council on Economic Advisors, none of the Council on Foreign Relations, none of the talking heads are ever holding responsible the people who caused this outsourcing of jobs that is just as fast today as it was. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think my thoughts probably fall into two separate territories. I mean, firstly, when it comes to the whole kind of sort of area of companies being taken over and, you know, being loaded up with debt, I think the first thing to remember is that, I mean, private equity in some ways is the oldest form of investing in the world. Long before you had public markets, You had private families, individuals, business people, etc., who set up a business, who would invest money into it, and they'd often go and take shares in other people's businesses as well. So in its purest form, it's actually just an old form of doing business, and it doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing by itself. However, I think what the current phenomenon of suddenly leveraging up shows is the fact that, firstly, we are very, very short-term in our sort of views of the world. You know, we are far more focused on making money in the here and now rather than actually thinking about sustainability. Secondly, what it also shows is how seductive the lure of debt actually is. Because the simple matter is that if you can go and borrow lots of money and not have to spend much of your own and make a ton of money that way, you will always do that. I mean, that's human incentive. I mean, at the end of the day, if you look at the housing bubble, for example, you know, that was fueled by the fact that at the end of the day, if a bank turned up to you and said that we will lend you a lot of money and ridiculous amounts, we would ask you to book onto negative amortization loans, things like that, people would take it. Why? Because the money was there on offer. I mean, in this country, in London, you know, I can tell you that, for example, around the time of the crisis, the levels of credit card debt were phenomenal. And there was a channel that did a very simple kind of experiment where they created a fictitious identity. It was a gentleman earning roughly around sort of $15,000 to $18,000 a year in your terms. And they went out, and within 3 months, they'd gotten him credit card lines of about $150,000. And, you know, the problem you have there is that that same phenomenon where an ordinary person can go out and take a ridiculous amount of credit card debt or mortgage debt, well, guess what? A big company can go out there and take out the most enormous amount of debt as well from the market, and the market will give it. What's, of course, happened in the last 20 years is that if you're a bank and you're sitting there looking at who to lend money to, you look at the individual, look at the big company, and you convince yourself the big company is a far better bet because they have a bigger balance sheet, they must be able to pay you back the loan you've made, and so you lend them an enormous amount of money. And, of course, what happens is you load it up with debt, and at some point, the debt servicing becomes far too much, and what is, as you said, often a good company can go under because it's unable to service that debt. And this comes down to the problem of debt we have in our society. We do need to deleverage the level of debt there, and we need to try and make some structural changes in how we are on a long-term basis. That's my first point. The second point is on the outsourcing front. Outsourcing is a very double-edged sword. Because on one hand, as you've noted, it takes away jobs and it causes enormous strains on the social fabric, particularly when a crisis hits, because there is nothing else to move on to. And people have a huge stigma attached to unemployment, where certainly, you know, and I've seen this repeatedly, where once you've been out of work for 1 year, 2 years, the longer you are, the harder it becomes to get back in a job. I mean, you know, people have a stigma about it. However, that same outsourcing also brought a lot of benefits to the U.S. economy. I mean, for example, you know, certainly over the last 20 years, the fact that there was an enormous positive deflationary effect across all the goods you might buy in the shops, you know, things like computers, things like food, you know, plastics, all this kind of stuff, came by the fact that effectively you were writing down the largest part of any product, which was the labor cost, and we're reducing it down enormously. And so that allowed people to sell things cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. I think, again, at some point, the myopia took over, where you became so obsessed with getting the cost down as a company that you forgot about the social cost of what you were doing, and you no longer had that longer-term perspective. Now, the problem is that if you're an individual or if you're a company, you try and do business in the environment you're in. You take advantage of all the incentives that are on the table. If there's a tax break, you'll take it. If there is, you know, a way to structure your balance sheet to get more money for less effort, you will do that. You know, the path of least effort is always the most popular, I think, for all humans. I think the tragedy is that the people at the top who are in charge of actually watching over a system and trying to make sure that it is sustainable, they're the ones who have also adopted a very similar shorter-term perspective. I mean, you know, the vast majority of policymakers are so focused always on fighting the urgent today that they very often forget about the important tomorrow. And so, you know, they develop their own myopia driven by perhaps electoral cycles or things like that, where they're constantly focused on GDP being up year in, year out, year in, year out. You know, they do not think about what the quality of that GDP is. I mean, it's a fetish for them. They don't think about, you know, what does that growth actually mean? Where is that demand coming from? Is it sustainable demand? Is it debt-free? Is it savings fueled? Is it something that we think is going to be that 10 years from now, or are we just simply, you know, layering up this debt cake in a way that's going to come crashing down on us in another couple of years?
I think that we have to be honest at some point of how much debt we actually have against our real gross domestic product, when about 22% of that gross domestic product is not actually benefiting most Americans. It's the financial industry's contribution. So that's completely circular, staying within their own banks and lending institutions. Now add on $17 trillion for the federal debt, add on that the Federal Reserve that we're responsible for is lend out over $21 trillion total. We only knew about $3 trillion until Bernie Sanders and Ron Paul got the audit to find out that 22 institutions took over 10,000 transactions for approximately $16 trillion. Now, they took bad, really terrible, toxic assets as collateral, which means that they took bad bets, cleaned them up, gave them clean money at 0.25%, functionally 0%, that they could then invest in emerging markets. None of that money went back to help Americans or small businesses or homeowners. Now you've got state debt of $6 trillion. You also have corporate debt of $25 trillion. You have credit card debt of about $830 billion. You have a student loan of $1.2 trillion. Then you add in your underfunded and unfunded liabilities of $122 trillion, and you're about $190 plus or minus trillion dollars. As compared to our gross domestic product of $15 trillion, you're looking at one of the highest ratios of debt to actual gross domestic product in the world. And yet, because we have a strong capacity as a central bank to backstop so many other banks, including the European National Bank, and other countries, nobody criticizes us. But if any other country, if Germany or Ireland or England had the same debt against their gross domestic product that we do, we'd be all over them. Can you explain this hypocrisy and the reality that we'll never be paying this debt off?
Well, I think you talk about, when you talk about the off-balance sheet items, I mean, the thing is that, you know, when something isn't recorded somewhere, people have a habit of forgetting it exists. I mean, you know, the number I had in my head came from a gentleman called Larry Kotlikoff, who's a professor at Boston University. And he's the father of what's known as intergenerational accounting, where he tries to understand what the liabilities are that we're fundamentally passing on to our children and grandchildren. And what he worked out was based on the CBO's own numbers, was that the gap between all of the projected spending and all of the projected taxes was $222 trillion last year. And he worked out that really was the equivalent of having to cut by 10% of GDP in perpetuity if you had to close that gap, which feasibly is never going to happen. And the number is so large that, to be honest, it's meaningless to me. It's very, very hard for me to conceive a number that large. And I think it is for most people, so they just tend to ignore it. You know, it's a form of black swan fatigue, I guess, for them. And what it's actually symptomatic of is, again, that whole problem of focusing on the urgent and never the important. I mean, a very good example, actually, is in U.S. history, is the American Civil War pension scheme. This was set up in 1862 to pay pensions to veterans that were disabled because of in the war, and also to pay to widows and to orphans and to any dependents they may have had if they got killed. Now, the problem, of course, is that this is a classic problem of making promises very lightly in the here and now. The incentive at the time was to try and get men to volunteer to fight in the Civil War on the Union side. This is prior to conscription coming in. And people never really tried to add up the promises they had made. Straight after the First World War, so the Union had won the Civil War, a number of lobbying organizations sprang up, most notably one called the Grand Army of the Republic, which was former Union soldiers, and they began to lobby for broader and broader benefits on the pension side. It got to the point where when you got into the 1880s, the Civil War pension liabilities actually used to make up 40% of the U.S. budget. And it became a hugely divisive issue. It's one of these episodes of history that people very often never talk about. In the end, Of course, as people then began to age and die off towards the 1890s and 1900s, the problem began to go away. But of course, then they hadn't really thought about human incentives and the way people behave. Because of course, around that time, you suddenly had a whole bunch of aging Civil War veterans who were in their 80s and 90s, and you had a lot of young women who looked at these veterans and saw them as annuities because they knew they had a pension that could pass on to a widow. The result was that suddenly at that point, there was a huge influx of new blood into this pension scheme of a much younger age, with the result that the last member of the Civil War pension scheme actually only died in 2004. 142 years after the scheme was set up. I mean, compared to what the war cost the U.S., the pensions associated with the war cost an enormous amount more. But of course, the problem is people never think about these longer-term implications. Instead, what they do is focus on the here and now. And the problem we have today is that we've done this on a global basis across everything. You talked about, you know, Social Security, Medicare, and so on. And because of that lack of planning, the tragedy is that, you know, we're probably living through, you know, what is still probably one of the best times. And actually, it's subsequent generations that are really going to suffer. If you go to Japan, for example, which has gone through this issue, I mean, you know, one of the constant complaints you have right now amongst the older generation in Japan, you know, the younger generation appear to have no motivation whatsoever. And my answer would be, well, of course they don't have any motivation. I mean, if you knew that you had to pay out the vast majority of your income and savings over the rest of your life, ultimately to support a bunch of promises that you had no part in making, you don't really feel very motivated to work. You know, you have nothing to really aim for. And the cost, the social cost of that, I think, will be enormous. Because the problem is that, bear in mind, no one will actually pay these debts off. What will happen is, and historically what always happens, and the financial crisis we have, by the way, are symptoms of this, is that as the debt builds up and builds up and builds up, at some point it becomes so large that society turns its back on it and rewrites the rules. And unfortunately, when it does that, it usually has huge catastrophic implications for the nature of society at that point in time. And those are the kind of major turning points we always think about when we look at history, things like the French Revolution, for example, or things like the 1920s and 1930s.
Very insightful. I was not aware of the Civil War pension scheme. I do know that Joseph Stiglitz and others in the economic field have projected that we will have between $3 and $5 trillion in ongoing medical expenses for those who have been disabled in the Afghan and Iraqi wars. And that was not a part of the original budgeting. If you remember, Donald Rumsfeld said it'll all be $200 billion, and that will easily be paid because of Iraqi oil paying for it. And now we see what its real costs and unintended costs are. Something that concerns me is that we have looked at China as the beacon for sustainable growth. I see China as a financial basket case. I see that on the one hand, with all of its determination based upon its political power and non-competitive nature, it has built 16 phantom cities that can house 63 million people, but no one lives there. It has built enormous infrastructure projects that are redundant or unnecessary or destructive. It has the worst pollution of any place in the world, and 16 of the top polluted cities in the world outside of Mexico City are in China. It is causing 600,000 people a year to die prematurely from pollution. On over 500,000 are developing cancer each year in the northern China, where they're given coal as a subsidy, and yet they're burning that coal inside, which is very unhealthy. They have 22,000 rivers and water bodies that are non-drinkable, non-swimmable, and non-fishable. And they have the fastest desertification in the world of any city. They're losing over 12,000 towns, hamlets, and communities per year to the desert overtaking them. Now, that's on the one hand a complete neglect of the environment, the human cost, and the exploitation of cheap labor. On the other hand, it did cause a massive 12 to even 13% one-time gross domestic product. They were on fire, and They also had savings of up to 47%, and they intentionally suppressed the value of their yuan so that it was easy for American companies to buy products that were once made in America, ship them into Walmart and Kmart and other stores, and sell them inexpensively to Americans. The irony of it is, how many Americans are buying things, cheap things made in China that they once made in the United States and made a living wage with? They must have forgotten from 1945 to 1975. In any case, now China is caught in a pickle because it has the largest group of educated, upper mobile, upper middle class people in the world. It surpassed India this past year. It's the second leading economy in the world. Its gross domestic product is between $10 and $11 trillion. But now we find out that just like Japan, that hid its real debt from us for a long time, China is immersed in a massive amount of debt, over $21 trillion. And that they have an outstanding loans that were made to cronies and business associates, and that the state has guaranteed, and they keep rolling over this debt, and now they see the consequences, and so they're slowing down, and now it's costing more. In fact, companies are not always going now to China. They're going to Vietnam, they're going to Thailand, they're going to Laos, they're going to other places that are still cheaper than China. So China has a massive pollution problem that they're not adequately addressing. They have massive poverty, still have 700 to 800 million destitutely poor people. They have over 300 million wealthy upper middle class people who are trying to emulate the American lifestyle. So here are all these people saying, look at Brazil, look at China, look at India, look at South Korea, South Africa, the BRICS nations. That's where we put our money. That's the future. Now I look at all those countries, and I'm seeing the devaluation of the Brazilian currency, the China currency, the Indian currency, the South African currencies. I'm seeing a slowdown. But we're talking about going from 10, 11% down to 5, 4, 3%. And what do you see happening in these countries? What do you see the influence of these countries are compared to the other countries in the world, where at one time they were the place, now not so much?
It's interesting how cycles come around, because, you know, if you go back to a few hundred years ago, I mean, to, let's say, the 1700s, for example, China and India at the time together used to make up, half of global GDP. And in fact, you know, famously, 300 years before that, when Genghis Khan's descendant Tamerlane was skiding across the whole of Asia, he got to the borders of Europe, looked across, and deemed the continent far too poor to bother with, and went back across instead to go back to China. So, you know, it's interesting how cycles change and come around again. China, I think, is a perfect poster child for the fetish of GDP. They are repeating Japan's mistake. That whole command capitalism model that they've adopted is fantastic in terms of driving enormous growth in the here and now. Unfortunately, you also take with it the bias of whichever individual set of individuals is driving that particular agenda. And they, unfortunately, no matter how smart they are, no matter how clever they are, etc., they will very rarely be able to appreciate the complexity of what they're creating. I mean, you gave some fascinating numbers on China there, and I can add one more to that mix. China, for example, at the moment is building enough office space to give every man, woman, and child in China their own 5x5 cubicle twice over, you know. I mean, this is mind-boggling and makes no sense. But what you can see is that in the metrics that we use to judge progress today, they will always show up as good spending, as GDP growth, as, you know, the 7, 8, 12% that is being reported. And that makes everyone believe that there's enormous growth there. But China does have enormous amount of debt, because the problem is when you have so much growth and you're fueling it purely by construction of one sort or the other, that growth is not going to be sustainable. You cannot keep building ad infinitum, because at some point the building has to stop. And unfortunately, at that point, all the money you borrow to do it is going to come home to roost. I mean, China had a financial crisis back in the late 90s, where, again, it was a bad debt crisis. And a lot of the bad debt actually at the time was transferred at face value onto new companies they set up, who took the debt on and simply did the classic Japanese motif of extend and pretend. Now, of course, that debt is also coming up for maturity, and it's becoming increasingly clear as some of those pieces of paper come through that actually they're not really worth the piece of paper they're written on in the first place. So, you know, running away from the problem hasn't solved it. This ostrich mentality doesn't help. What China has also done is suppressed the wages of its people that would have naturally risen precisely because it gave the competitive advantage that you mentioned in the U.S. and other developed countries. And what it meant was that while they were having this phenomenal growth thanks to all of the investment they were doing in infrastructure and so on, what they were never doing was actually prepping the consumer in the backyard to actually take over the baton at some point and carry on that growth. And the real problem China now has is that, unfortunately, they're trying to now suddenly focus on consumption as a driver of growth going forward, but any growth they get from that is going to be far lower than what they've had to date. And politically, that's very hard for them to accept. And so the result is that even though there have been a number of people been warning about the Chinese debt bubble for at least the last 4 or 5 years, if not longer, they've doggedly refused to consider it until, I guess, it becomes far too late. Now, if you go look at most emerging markets in general, India, Brazil, and so on, you know, I believe some of them do have some genuinely good stories in there. But I think what always happens is whenever people see a good opportunity and they run into it, at some point, once some people start to make money, everybody else looks across the fence and says, well, this guy's making money. Why the hell am I not in there as well? And they quickly pile in. I mean, they abdicate thought completely, and they simply go by what the next guy is buying and what, you know, their so-called gurus, experts, stock pickers, whatever you want to call them, are telling them the next hot thing is. And so the result is they pile in enormous quantities without necessarily bothering to think about the fundamentals or why they're going into it or what the whole story is all about. And you will see that. I mean, a very good example is in the dot-com boom, where, you know, fundamentally the internet was going to change society. We've seen that in the last 20 years. But people took that, you know, future growth and hyped it up to the extent where they were paying the most ridiculous amounts of money for that little slice of the future. I mean, you know, you had PE ratios that got up to the hundreds, even 1,000. I mean, the idea of waiting 1,000 years to get your money back doesn't even make sense. I mean, Japan went through a very similar phenomenon. The other one I, of course, always remember, which is another fascinating example into how people always think about these opportunities, is back in the 1890s, you had a very similar analog to the internet boom, which was the bicycle boom. So bicycles, of course, had just been invented in the 1870s and were starting to become very popular. And so suddenly people saw this as the most enormous market because clearly these were mechanized transport, therefore they lasted longer. They were much cheaper than getting a horse and carriage. You know, some people even pointed out that because they could be ridden by both men and women, the market was automatically therefore twice as large. So, you know, they had all these kind of visions of hypergrowth. What was also interesting was that because bicycles had become quite popular at that stage, a very large, powerful lobbying group of bicycle owners had formed who actually lobbied successfully to build the first roads in the U.S. between cities. So the first roads weren't actually built for cars, they were built for bicycles. And so, again, you know, the analysts that were looking at all of this, you know, saw this network of roads, you know, projected it outwards ad infinitum. I mean, extrapolation is a beautiful human tool, and decided that therefore meant that these bicycle companies were going to make the most enormous fortune. And, of course, they hadn't thought at all about the realities, which was that growth isn't infinite. For example, if I buy a bicycle today, I'm hardly likely to go out and buy one tomorrow. I'm probably going to buy one maybe in 5 years, perhaps 10, depends how durable it is. You know, the fact is not everyone's going to want one. The fact of the matter is something else may come along and disrupt it, as did happen with the car only a few years later. And people never think about these things. They get so seduced by the money on offer today that they completely ignore what often in hindsight are very valid warning signs about the pitfalls that are actually out there.
Appreciate that insight. Thank you. Let's take a look at something that's a big bubble now, and that is that the equity partnerships and other financial groups have bought up hundreds of thousands of foreclosed homes, and now they're they're packaging them and selling them once again, as they did the subprime mortgage homes, to people making their money and giving promises of what these are going to be worth for the rental market. At the same time, the banks are in the shadow economy, shadow because the people are not aware of it, holding millions of homes off the market to keep the homes that are on the market at an artificially higher position. Now, this is a big bubble out there. And I went to see about a home. I was going with a friend who wanted to get my input in Florida, who wanted to buy a home, and felt that now that they were at auction, they could afford an auction home. After all, the home was worth $300,000. They estimated to go for $80,000. That would be a good deal. They'd pay cash for it. They wouldn't have any mortgage. And then as it in time grew, in a historically 1% to 2% per year in value, then they would have something for the future. Well, suddenly one person bought 200 homes that day at lower than $80,000. And no one else had a chance to buy anything. And it turns out this is a person that actually worked with the bank. And in fact, the banks are frequently buying back their own properties, and they already got the advantage of whatever someone paid in interest and premium while the person was in the home. Then they mark it off at 100% tax loss at the full value, and then they got different deals with the government to keep some of the people in their homes with a deal that benefited the banks more than the people. And now they're getting the home back way under market value so they can repackage these and sell them to investors. And yet we're not talking about this. We're saying instead all these people on talking heads on media, MSNBC, for example, are saying, oh, you know, recovery in the real estate market. We don't have a recovery because to have a real recovery, you have to have a recovery of masons, plumbers, electricians, landscape architects. You have to have a recovery in the companies that make the carpet, the tiles for the roofs, the shingles, the wood, the sidings. You don't. You don't see these. You don't see the large movements in this. You did. You had a massive boom that fueled, in some cases, 100% year. I know because my property was one of the ones that went up 100% per year for almost 7 years, 700% appreciation in my own house. I said, well, it's paid for. I don't like mortgages, and I don't really care what it goes up to because it's a bubble and it's going to come down. And I warned my friends, don't be buying. All of them took the wrong advice. Instead, they saw how they could buy something and flip it, and they all got creamed because of this. And so now we have this other bubble. Could you address this bubble that's out there now that we're not paying attention to?
Well, everyone loves easy money, don't they? I mean, I think this bubble is one that is going to go on for a lot longer simply because what's also fueling it, by the way, is that, you know, banks and private equity firms and all the people who are playing with these homes are also responding to the supply and demand they see out there. And one of the biggest demands you will see is actually from pension plans and insurance companies, because one of the unintended consequences of all the quantitative easing and the stimulus we've done is that we've driven rates down to such ludicrous levels that actually in real terms, for most savers, and most savers ultimately sit in pension plans or insurance companies in one way or the other, for most of them, they are making no money on their savings at all. If anything, in real terms, they're probably losing money now. And so what it means is that for a lot of these institutions, there's an enormous crush for yield. They're demanding yield at any cost. And you see that in areas like, for example, junk bonds is a very good example, where junk bonds are called junk bonds for a reason. They actually don't have a very good credit quality. Yet, the yield on junk bonds has actually cratered simply because so much institutional money has poured into that market desperately looking for yield. And now that that's come down, they've now moved on to find yield somewhere else. So, for example, property is a hugely popular area where they're all looking for yield. And, you know, they're looking at the paperwork, they're looking at the promises, they're looking at their projections, and they're buying into that. And so that's driving this huge demand. And, of course, the banks and the private equity firms who ultimately are looking for where they can profiteer will happily step in to provide that transaction and to make that money. Now, I think the problem is that unless you actually return the economy to any kind of normal state, you will never really be able to get rid of that bubble until it explodes. You know, the same people on MSNBC and others that you talk about who say the house prices are going up are also by the same people who will be pointing to an unemployment rate that is coming down. They will very rarely talk as much about the job participation rate that is also coming down even faster. So, you know, I think the bubble you have there is one that is being fueled by all the decisions we took in recent years. And what my big fear actually is that because we have created a bubble now where since the money that is being pumped into the economy doesn't actually go through the economy anymore, it simply pools at the front end where the financial markets are, all that money now just ends up in the financial markets one way or the other. And so you create all these asset price bubbles. You know, the financial health of the economy is great. the real health of the economy is terrible and there's an enormous disconnect, but nobody seems to care about that anymore. And so what you have is behind the scenes, you have what used to be a crisis of finance actually now rapidly becoming a crisis of society. And if you don't take steps to address that, what you end up with is a far more weakened society and ultimately not a sustainable one.
Last quick answer on this. What do you see in the foreseeable future happening to the economy and people's quality of life and standard of living in the United States?
Well, I think in the future, what you will see at the moment is you will see asset prices will carry on going up. People will be very euphoric in the financial markets because it's the opportunity. I think, by the way, we will also see a huge growth in inequality for that same reason. Because unfortunately, the one problem with debt is few people own debt, a lot of people owe it, and so you have a regular transfer of wealth from the many to the few. And so what you will see is that the social strains over the next few years will also carry on growing, much as the financial markets carry on growing as well. And the danger is that policymakers focus on only one and not the other.
I really appreciate you coming on, sharing your insights. We've learned a great deal from you today. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Gary. It's been great being on the show.
Dr. Bob Swaroop from London, United Kingdom, and he is the author of Money Mania, Booms, Panics, and Busts from Ancient Rome to the Great Meltdown. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you very much for listening.